I needed to not skate by for once in my life, and they didn't let me.
At the end of the day, if you know that you don't feel good about the job, you gotta be able to leave that behind.
They just kept asking me to come back, and I truly love Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin.
It's always great to be at WTMJ.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. The Buckinghams are celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. And as one of Chicago's premier rock bands of the 60s, they've been performing their hits like Kind of a Drag and Hey Baby, plus they're playing their song, for over six decades. And joining us on our Siding Unlimited talk and text line is one of the original members of the Buckinghams, Carl Giamorisi. And Carl, I heard you kind of go, does that mean 60 years you've been doing that?
As you were speaking, I was thinking to myself, oh my God, wow, 60 years. How did that happen? You know, it's incredible. But, you know, we're very fortunate, very grateful for the success we've had over the course of 60 years. And I have to attribute it to a great fan base who still loves to hear these songs. You know, they just embrace our music still after all these years. You know, we just played a show at the Egyptian Theater in DeKalb Sunday, and it was sold out. That was just amazing.
Well, you guys sell out every time you play. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of your new music in just a couple minutes. But if you don't mind, Carl, can you take us back 60 years and how the band got together, how you got started, and, well, that behind the scenes that everybody's wondering about?
Well, of course, we were quite young, band just starting out. It was 1965. We were playing, at that time, dances and teen hops were really happening, you know, especially dances around Chicago. There were venues like the Holiday Ballroom and the Embassy Ballroom and the Vogue. And, you know, so that kept us working every weekend. I mean, I was a high school kid making a living already from playing in a band, you know, just getting paid. It was amazing, you know, very grateful for that. I never even had to have an allowance because I was making money. So, you know, we got together, you know, as a Chicago musician, we all knew each other from different bands and playing different venues. So the Buckinghams were formed from a couple different bands. There was a group called the Pulsations that were playing around the city. And then I was in a band called the Centuries. And this is 1965. So my band broke up and I wound up joining the Pulsations. And we were that for about, I think, about 3 months. When we landed a TV show in Chicago on WGN, there was a variety show called All Time Hits. It was a new show. It was for 13 weeks, starting in September of 65. And so we won the audition to be the rock band on the show. And they didn't like the name Pulsation, so they changed our name to the Buckinghams. I think they really wanted to capitalize on the British invasion.
I've heard differing stories that you were named after Buckingham Palace, or was it Buckingham Fountain in Chicago? Which was it?
Well, it could be a little of both. I mean, Buckingham Palace was definitely an influence because, like I said, the British invasion, it sounded British. We couldn't believe that nobody was already calling themselves the Buckinghams when we decided to go with that. And we did have the beautiful Buckingham Fountain, too, in Chicago, which is pretty cool. As a matter of fact, our first album, the Kind of a Drag album, our record label kept threatening to just put a black cover on the album if we didn't hurry up and come up with something to put on the cover. So we all went down to the lakefront, stood in front of Buckingham Fountain, and a friend of ours had a new Polaroid camera, and he took a picture of us. And of course, the quality of a Polaroid, when you blow it up the size of an album, you can't even tell what's going on in the picture. It was so distorted. So it just looks like us in front of a bunch of lights. Because it was nighttime and the lights were on. But yeah, I guess we're, you know, there's a relationship there to Chicago and the fountain. But mostly it was just because of the British invasion.
Carl, you were a kid, like you said, high school kid. Had to be a little bit daunting the first time you stepped into a recording studio.
Well, yes, it was. I mean, it was, we were totally inexperienced. I mean, we hadn't even been playing that long as a band. I mean, I started playing guitar. I started taking guitar lessons when I was 13. And so I hadn't been playing that long. And then when when that song took off, I was just a senior in high school when it was a number one record.
What was the reaction of the kids you were going to school with?
They were pretty excited for me, you know, my whole clique of friends. You know, unfortunately, I went to an all-boys high school. So me and my friends, we would visit a lot of the other schools and hit girls.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I don't know how to explain it. I was exploding with excitement because, oh my God.
Carl Giamarisi from the Buckinghams describes what it was like to have a number one record when he was still a senior in high school.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Carl Giamarisi from the Buckinghams. So here you are, a senior in high school. You got a number one song on the radio, Kind of a Drag. What was the first time you ever heard it on the radio?
First time I heard it, I was in my car, and I heard it on the radio, and I believe it was WLS. It was just, I don't know how to explain it. I was exploding with excitement because, oh my God. And then, you know, coming through the speaker in a car, it was a whole different sound. You know what I mean? You're used to hearing songs on the radio, you know, and it had that certain radio sound to it. And it hits you all at once. Oh my God, we are being played on the radio. You know, we have a hit.
That first song, you hit number one, it was like December 31st of 66. Or was that the debut of it?
That was pretty much, well, it debuted in Chicago even a little bit before that. I know by February of 67, it was the number one record, and it was on Billboard's and Cashbox number one spot. It actually knocked the Monkees, I'm a Believer, right off the number one spot.
So then, 67 was a huge year for the Buckinghams. It was one hit after another after another.
Yeah. You know, the record label, they kept pushing for, you know, they wanted to release another song, I'd say every few months at least. They wanted to keep you up on top of the charts. So we were very fortunate. We moved from recording in Chicago at the iconic Chess Studios, which was a blues studio mainly at that time. Some of the great blues performers like Muddy Waters had recorded there, and Chuck Berry, and, you know, there were a lot of, you know, even the Stones recorded, because the Stones were leaning toward being a blues band at the very beginning of their career. So they came to Chicago and did their first album at Chess. So we went from there. There was a big change in our career after Kind of a Drag. You know, we had left our manager that we had in Chicago. We signed with Gercio and Evans, another manager, Jim Gercio, who originally was from Chicago, but he was out in L.A. at the time. He came in and talked us into signing with him, and then he brought us to Columbia Records. So we went from a Chicago-based label, USA Records, which is what Kind of a Drag was released on, to Columbia Records right after Kind of a Drag. So the rest of the recordings we did, and like I said, the label was pushing you every few months for a new song. So we started recording in New York City after that. And luckily we had a great songwriter, Jim Holvey, and his partner, Gary Beisbeer, but mainly Jim. Jim Holvey wrote Kind of a Drag, and they wrote Don't You Care. If you don't love me. Hey Baby, they're playing our song. It's Susan. And so he was feeding us these great songs, and we kept going in the studio and recording them.
Here you are, though. You're, what, a year or two out of high school at this point? How much pressure was that on you and the other band members to keep bringing out hits?
Yeah, there was pressure, but we were having such a good time, and we're young, and we had the energy. I'll tell you, it made a big difference to have four other band members that were in the same place as you to bounce off of and lean on and so forth. I mean, that helped a great deal because we were very close. We were good friends too. We weren't just bandmates, you know, we were, you know, typical Chicago neighborhood guys, and we were able to embrace that and each other, and that helped with the pressure, because there was some pressure in trying to keep it together and traveling. In 1967, my gosh, we must have played close to 300 dates that year.
Aside from traveling and playing those dates, what other pressures were you under?
Well, you felt the pressure at home to some degree, because a lot of your friends and people around you, they may say, oh, we acted different, or we were different with that success. But in reality, they became different the way I saw it. You know, they started treating us differently, and we didn't really want that. And there was, you know, some family pressure from the family, and performing, you know, I mean, we were doing a lot of TV shows in the 60s. So you felt the pressure of performing, because some of those shows we were performing live also.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those shows, because if you grew up in the 60s or the 50s for that matter, American Bandstand was huge. And you guys were on it with Dick Clark. First time you stepped into that studio must have been a real big moment for you?
Oh, it was life-changing to be there in front of Dick Clark. You know, after I had watched American Bandstand for many years before that, you know, and was very familiar with him and with his show. And to be asked to come on as a guest was a great honor. And we were a bit nervous. As a matter of fact, when he interviewed us, he was interviewing Dennis Tufano, our band member. And Dennis, when you look at how you realize how nervous he was, you know, he was really not himself, I don't think, because he was a pretty outgoing, articulate guy, really. And you could tell that there was pressure from all of us. You're standing there going, oh, my God, we're here with Dick Clark, the one and only Dick Clark. But we got to know him through the years because years later, you know, I think it was in the 80s, maybe, Dick was doing some corporate events. And he would use us as the rock band on the show. So, you know, I remember sharing a dressing room with Dick Clark. So we became pretty good friends, you know, to that point. And it was nice of him to include us, you know, in that.
Some of the other shows you did included, and this now has become legendary, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And, you know, at the time, that show, well, they raised a few hackles among people because of some of the bits they were doing. But the guests who performed on it were huge, and you were one of them.
Oh, yeah. And the show was on the cutting edge. And there was a little controversy on this show because there were some political digs that they would get into, so they weren't real popular with a certain segment in the country and maybe the government, I don't know. But they were kind of outspoken in a subtle way. And everybody wanted to do the show, and it was the show at the time. I think it was June of 67 that we made an appearance on the show. And I always tell this story on stage. It's kind of funny because it was our first time out to California to do a TV show. I remember going out to the CBS studios to actually record the show, tape it, and they escorted us up onto the stage to do a run-through and get everything in order. And the whole stage was decorated in such a way that reflected the British invasion. They thought we were a British group, let me just put it that way. They didn't even know, the producers of the show, I guess, they thought that we were a British band. So if you go to YouTube now, you can find it, and it's all over the place. You see us on stage performing, because they didn't change the set. We just left it the way it was. So you see the Union Jack on stage and the British flags hanging in the background. So they mistakenly thought we were a British band, and we were a bunch of guys from Chicago.
I was going to say, what was your reaction when you walked on stage and you saw that set?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it really bothered us very much, you know. It was wrong, and of course we brought it to their attention right away. But we didn't object, you know. I don't know if it would have done any good at that point, because it looked like they went through a lot of trouble to get it up and running and looking the way it did. So we just did the show as it was, as they had set it up to be, and that was that.
Did you have any interaction with any of the people on that show, Tommy, Dick, Smothers, some of the musicians, because they had some great musicians, too, playing for them?
Yeah, I don't remember too much anymore, but yeah, I do recall, you know, talking to some of the players and musicians, and Tom and Dick Smothers were very friendly, and I believe it was Dick Smothers, he had his car was a Porsche, and I just love that car. As a matter of fact, I think about a year or so later, I went out and bought one, you know, after seeing his car.
Still have that car?
I'm a car guy too. You know, I just love sports cars. You know, so
do you still have that car?
I wish I did. Libby, I wish I did. Gosh, that, you know, Dawn Lee Wakefield, who's our publicist, she says, oh, you should write a little story about each car that you've ever owned, which came to about, I think, 25 cars. And it was fun for me to do. So I wrote a little short paragraph about, because with every car I owned, I could tell you what I was doing or what was going on in my life at that time. There's that relationship to the car. So I actually had fun doing that. But that 69 Porsche I had, of all the cars, I'd say it was my favorite, at least in the top three.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
Everybody wanted to do Ed Sullivan. It was the epitome of success. It gave you a feeling of such accomplishment, like you finally made it.
Carl Giammarisi from the Buckinghams talks about walking on the same stage as the Beatles. It was the Ed Sullivan Show.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Carl Giammarisi from the Buckinghams. So let's go to 1968, when any band that ever was on the Ed Sullivan Show. That's got to be a moment that stands out in your mind forever. The energy that must have been around that, being on that stage where bands like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones had performed. Where were you when you found out you booked that?
I wish I could remember exactly where I was when I found out we were doing that show. I know I was back in Chicago. When our manager announced to us that we were doing Ed Sullivan, it was, oh my God, we were through the roof. Because, you know, everybody wanted to do Ed Sullivan. It was the epitome of success if you were invited to play on the really big show. So we were just blown away to have that opportunity. It gave you a feeling of such accomplishment, like you finally made it. And we did already made it. We already had a string of hit records, and we had been touring, and things were going really well. But for some reason, the Ed Sullivan Show was sort of like putting the period on the whole thing, you know, that you really did it. So going out to New York to do that was just, you know, being on the same stage that you knew that Elvis performed on, especially the Beatles, because we all wanted to be the fifth Beatle at that time. We were such big fans. So it was such an honor and a privilege to be on that stage in that theater. It was just, it's like kind of a world. I hardly remember. It went by so quick and there was so much going on, but we did it. You could still find the old footage of us on the show.
Do you remember who else was on that show?
It really is a blur.
After you did that, and I think you debuted the song, Susan. On that show, didn't you?
Yeah. It was pretty cutting edge because Susan had this, it's kind of strange, but there's this psychedelic interlude after the first bridge of the song that comes in, and it's kind of weird sounds, and I don't know if our manager producer was thinking about maybe influenced by the Beatles, A Day in the Life, what they did in that song, but it was pretty strange. So when that part came in, we were performing it on the Ed Sullivan stage, and then they switched to some video of us. We did kind of a quirky monkeys video thing, running around the beach and doing crazy stuff while that was playing, and then it cuts back to us on stage performing toward the end of the song. But that was, the producers of the show allowed us to keep that in, because a lot of radio stations back in the day would edit that part out, go right from the bridge into the ending. I don't know. I mean, none of us liked it at the beginning when our producer put that in there, but it's become sort of a controversial, something to talk about, you know. People always ask me about that.
That was about the time, though, music really began to change. As you said, the Beatles changed things. The Beach Boys had Pet Sounds. I guess, you know, the psychedelic era and everything, which wasn't really your identity as the band, the Buckinghams. No. That's when things started to slow down for you.
Yeah, I would say by 69, that's when there was a big change. I mean, we went from AM to FM radio almost overnight, and their formats allowed songs to be. There was a rule that a pop group or your single had to be about 2 minutes, no more than 2 minutes and 20-some seconds or whatever it was. And then all of a sudden, there's FM and songs are 4 minutes. And then the groups were coming out. I think what really changed it to begin with, some of these big festivals, the Monterey Pop Festival, California, and of course Woodstock, more underground sound, it was catching on. And like I said, the media and FM radio helped that along. And all of a sudden, these groups were making concept albums that people were really into. Groups like Cream and Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Santana. It was a different sound, you know. And groups like us, we were pop top 40 bands. We were capable of playing, but our audience was buying into us doing that. So groups like us and the Turtles and Grassroots and Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, and we were sort of left in limbo, and it was harder and harder to keep it together. We even tried, we did a concept album, which I really think is a masterpiece, called Portraits, where it was a concept album where the songs kind of connected to one another, and it was pretty advanced for our sound because we had that capability as musicians by that point. But the audience was not buying into it.
Was there any time during that period where you thought, okay, I got to find something else to do besides play music?
Yeah, I'd say by 69, end of 69, going into 70. I mean, the Buckinghams broke up right at the beginning of 1970. original Buckingham, Dennis Tufano, always jokes, well, we were a 60s band, so it's 1970, so we had to break up. Like, that was the rule. You know, things were going so well, and you have to understand, at our age, in the teens, you don't really think about your future that much. You know, you're having a good time, you're living in the moment, and you don't think about it. But then that was sort of a wake-up call. Okay, what am I going to do the rest of my life? You know, we certainly didn't make enough money to retire, because even though we were able to generate a lot of income, we were being ripped off by managers and producers and the record labels and the deals we had. We were a stereotype of what was going on back then. We were one of many artists that were being taken advantage of, you know. So it wasn't like we could just retire and that'd be the end of it. So, you know, like I said, 1970 came along and we realized we were losing ground. We were losing our audience by then.
How bad were those ripoffs by the managers and the people around you?
Really bad. Unfortunately, our parents were ignorant of the business. They didn't know, and they were several steps ahead of you, the record labels and the managers and so forth. So the deals were always made to benefit them more than us. So getting pennies on a record, and, you know, it just wasn't, you know, even the live performances, we were put on a salary, and, you know, here we were playing to large audiences. And we were probably at that time probably earning about $2,000-$3,000 a night, which was a lot of money back then. I always remember hearing the top American band at that time was the Beach Boys, and they were getting about $10,000 performance.
But that was for the whole band, and you had to split it, right?
No, we weren't even split it. Management put us on a salary. We were getting a couple $100 a week apiece.
That was it?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was it. Who knows where the money went. I mean, luckily, I came to an agreement with Sony. Columbia became Sony Music. I came to an agreement with them. I got into the business end of it. When Nick Fortuna and I brought the Buckinghams back in 1980, then I contacted Sony, and we were able to go back and look at the royalties. You could go back a certain amount of time, and I was able to retrieve a large portion of royalties. We realized that we didn't get paid and we should have had. And ever since then, I've had a relationship with Sony now that twice a year they pay us.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
The jingle was da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you deserve a break today at McDonald's. It was a very lucrative business.
Carl Giamarisi talks about being a jingle singer in Chicago.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Carl Giamarisi from the Buckinghams. You mentioned when you and Nick got back together in the 80s. Were you surprised how enthusiastic your fans were?
Well, it blew me away. I didn't see it coming. I really didn't. In the 70s, when we broke up, myself and Dennis Tufano formed a duo. We were singer-songwriters. We wanted to get into that whole songwriting singer. You know, we were following James Taylor, the Eagles, Carol King, Joni Mitchell. That's what we were embracing and we loved, and that's what we wanted to do. And we were very lucky. We connected with the great record producer, record label, Ode Records, and the great producer Lou Adler. And Lou had just come off of Carol King's album Tapestry, which was the biggest album there ever was at that time. I think it was around 1971, if I remember correctly. And he signed us based on a song I wrote and a demo that we recorded. And we wound up doing three albums with Ode Records out in L.A. from the beginning of the 70s until about 76. And it was a great opportunity for us, and we were having a great time out there. We just couldn't come up with the hits. But it was an interesting time. I had the opportunity to work with some great musicians in the studio, Tom Scott and the L.A. Express and, you know, different people. It was a great time for us to make music and be creative. And by 1976, that fell apart and we broke up. And I wound up back in Chicago as what they call a jingle singer. You know, I started singing. I connected with some friends of mine who were very well-known singers and musicians in the business. And Chicago was a major jingle town.
What were some of the jingles you did?
Oh, gosh. I did so many back in that time. Between, from say, 1976 till about 81, I sang lead on some of the beer commercials, RC Cola, a lot of McDonald's. You deserve a break today at McDonald's, you know.
That was
Big Mac, filet of fish, quarter pounder French fries, icy Coke, thick shakes, sundaes, and apple pies. And then the jingle was da 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 da. You know, you deserve a break today at McDonald's.
You deserve a break today. So get up and get away to McDonald's.
was me, and it was a very lucrative business. And it was a lot going on. And like I said, Chicago and New York was probably where most of the ad agencies were here, you know, in Chicago. And the studios were buzzing. I mean, we were jumping around from one studio to the next in Chicago and downtown in the city. So that kept me going until 1980. Is like you asked me, what did I think about? Like I said, it caught me by surprise when all of a sudden there was a resurgence in our music. And I got a phone call from the program director at WLS. His name was John Guerin. And John said, is there any chance that you guys could get back together for a reunion show at Navy Pier for Chicago Fest? And we hadn't really thought about doing something like that. I mean, it was discussed at different times, but we could never get it together. So I called Nick Fortuna, who is with me till today, and Dennis Tufano was out in California. He was willing to come in and do it. And our keyboard player, Marty Greb, was performing with Chicago as part of the band in Chicago, so he wasn't available. So we got a few other musicians together and rehearsed a couple weeks, did the concert at Navy Pier up on top of the end of the pier there, and 12,000 people showed up, and we were just blown away. I mean, it was just the excitement, the enthusiasm, and I could feel that something was happening. So we played a couple other venues with success, and then the next year, Dennis Tufano came back. We did the Park West Theater in Chicago. We did a few. There was a concert company promoters called Jam Productions, and they were booking us for some of their events around Chicago. But I realized right away that, hey, this is taken off on a national level, and I thought I could bring Nick and Dennis into Chicago and we could maybe do a new album, some new songs. It had only been about 10 years. And at first, Dennis Tufano, because he was our original singer at the time, and he agreed to come in and do it. But then once he came in, I knew something was up, and he just said he was involved in a lot of things going on in LA, and he didn't want to be at Buckingham again. He didn't want to go out and tour. So Nick Fortuna urged me. He said, hey, why don't we do it anyway? So we realized quickly that as long as we had two original members and a good band, people wanted to hear those hits again. So we signed with an agency, and the rest is history. We started getting offers and offers to play, and this is, you know, like around 1982, and it kept getting bigger and more events, and we signed with another agency, and several years later, and we did a PBS special. I've performed the Buckinghams on two inaugurations. We played for George Bush's second inauguration and Barack Obama's.
Which was a bigger thrill, playing at a presidential inauguration or being on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Oh, I'd probably say Ed Sullivan.
I don't know how.
No slap in the face.
I don't know.
Because they were great. They were great events. I mean, I mean, we played for the agricultural ball for both Bush and Obama's, and it was a great audience, and they had a wonderful time. And I remember for Obama's, there had to be a million people out there. It was wild. It was crazy. Crazy time.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
It was very successful, and it was a 60s show. It was mostly a Chicago show, but we turned it into a live show.
Carl Giammarisi from the Buckinghams talks about the excitement of recording a TV show for PBS.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Carl Giammarisi from the Buckinghams. I'm your host, Libby Collins. You mentioned the PBS special, and for the last 7 years, the Cornerstones of Rock, American Garage, has been playing on PBS stations throughout the country, bringing you back to a whole national audience. Are you finding that you're getting younger fans?
Yeah, to some degree. I'm always surprised when we come out to the autograph table, signed CDs and whatever. And they line up. I mean, people are very enthusiastic and very friendly. And it's fun. It's fun for us, too. And I'm surprised when I see younger people. A lot of times they're with their parents or grandparents, or somehow that they got connected to the music and wound up embracing it. And so you occasionally see, you know, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, even 40-year-olds, that's young for us now, you know, I mean, based on how long we've been around. So it is a thrill to see younger people come out to the shows. Talk about a PBS special. We did the Cornerstones of Rock. It was a PBS show that was on, well, Channel 11 here, but it was very successful. It played in all the markets. It played a few times, and it was a 60s show with the Ides of March, The Crying Shames, the New Colony Six. It was mostly a Chicago show. There was about five or six acts at that time. But we turned it into a live show, and we do probably about three or four Cornerstones of Rock shows a year, and mainly around the Chicago Midwest area. So that's been going on for about 10 years, and I can't believe that it sells out every time. You know, it just does great.
What's really wonderful is after 60 years of the Buckinghams being out there, that you're still writing and recording new music. And I guess you have a new single called Let the Music Play, which is from an album of the same name.
Yeah, it's something I have to do, which is my creative juices. I have to create new music. I'm always writing and recording. And with the new way of making music, which is computer-based, I record at home, and then I have a good friend who's a top-notch engineer who works for Jim Peterik, Larry Millis. He'll take my songs after I put it all together. I send it to him, all the tracks, and he puts it together for me. And he turns a great-sounding demo into a real nice-sounding record for me, you know. So I've been working with him on this album, and we've got 10 songs, and Let the Music Play is the name of the album. And that's the lead track. You know, I started writing that song, and at first I didn't think it really had legs, you know, like it was going to turn into something. But as I kept working on it, it just kept developing. And before I knew it, it was title track for the album. And so, like I said, I don't think about having hit records again, but I just need to be creative and put out new music and have fun with it. And it's a great desire of me to write lyrics, and whether it be a love song or there's one song on the album called Monday Morning, which had to do with, you know, Nick and I have been on the Happy Together tour several times, probably of the 15 years it's been around, we've been on about seven of those tours. And it's grueling, especially at this age, you know, to be playing 3 months solid, 58 shows, and you're all over the country is a pretty grueling, taxing schedule. Monday Morning is a story about finally getting home and being back with the ones you love and getting off the road. So it's just these things come up, thoughts like Let the Music Play is really a celebration of the music that we can't stop, that I want to keep making music as long as I can. As long as the people want to hear us play, we'll keep playing. And as God willing, I have the health to do it, I'll keep making music. So I want to hear the music play is one of the lines in the song, and that's mainly what it's about. It's just a celebration of music, and it's a party. It was a fun album to do.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
We don't usually get to play in a more intimate setting. It's the right kind of intimate setting where you can really connect with the audience because they're right there in front of you.
Carol Giamarisi from the Buckinghams talks about celebrating their 60th anniversary in music.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Carol Giamarisi from the Buckinghams.
You're going to be back in Wisconsin at the Belfry Theater in Delavan in July. I assume, in addition to all those Buckingham hits, you might play a couple of the ones from the new album?
It's possible. We're going to try to make those two shows, those two nights at the Belfry, a 60th anniversary celebration. Maybe have some extra things going on there. I love playing that theater. Now, that's an unusual venue for us. We don't usually get to play in a more intimate setting like the Belfry. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't, but I've heard wonderful things about it.
Well, it's great. It's an old theater at one time. I think they used to perform plays there. It holds about 270 people, maybe, I want to say. So that's pretty small from what we're used to. You know, we go in there for two nights. I've been playing that theater for probably almost 10 years and going in there mainly in the summer. Of course, we've done a Christmas show there too. And I just love going in there. It's the right kind of intimate setting where you can really connect with the audience because they're right there in front of you and it's easy to see everybody. And, you know, and it's just a fun the venue to play at, and Michael Deutsch, who runs that theater, is a great guy, and they do a great job. So we're going to be there in July, and hopefully it'll be as successful as it has been over the course of the last 7, 8, 9 years.
I imagine it will be. Obviously, a lot of people always want to come and see the Buckinghams, and especially this year, your 60th anniversary, which I can't believe. I mean, it seems like it was just yesterday when you debuted some of those songs, Kind of a Drag and Don't You Care. Carl, one last question for you, because I assume you're going to keep playing music as long as you can. But if somebody said to you, you can play music, Carl, but you can only sing
one Buckingham song, what would it be?
Oh, I would say Don't You Care. Don't You Care, which was our first big hit on the Columbia label. It came right after Kind of a Drag. And it's one of my favorite recordings because it was a few steps up. You know, we were in a studio. The technology changed a lot. You know, we went from an 8-track to a 16-track studio. And we had a great producer, Jim Gersio. And so the quality of it. But I like the song a lot.
Everybody likes you a lot. And we look forward to seeing you, the Buckinghams, Nick Fortuna. Again, two of the original members of the Buckinghams. I can't thank you enough for talking with us today, Carl.
Well, Libby, thank you for giving me the time to babble on like this. There's always a lot to say when regarding music and the Buckinghams, but I appreciate it. I hope you could join us.
We'd love to see you again. Carl Giammarisi from the Buckinghams, thank you again.
Thank you, Libby.
We've been talking with Carl Giammarisi from the Buckinghams. He talked about being a high school senior with a hit record and also the excitement of stepping on stages and doing TV shows like The Ed Sullivan Show and The Smothers Brothers. He also talked about what he's doing today. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Carl, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.